This talk is from the 3rd Annual Illinois Catholic Prayer Breakfast, held April 30th, 2010 in Chicago. For more information, go to www.illinoiscatholicprayerbreakfast.com. For more talks by excellent Catholic speakers, go to greatcatholichomilies.com. This is part 2 of the talk of Bishop Salvatore Cordiglione, the Bishop of the Diocese of Oakland, California.
Again, we recognize a hierarchy of values, but we understand how all of these issues are interconnected and all are necessary for a moral society, for a healthy society. Now, one does not need to be Catholic to understand this, but our Catholic tradition does make it a lot easier, and we have to help the people of our nation get there, and that includes many of our own people. Many of our own people don't understand this. Preeminent among all of these issues, though, at this moment of history, is the marriage issue, because everything is riding on that. And again, that's why I ended up getting involved in this, what became Proposition 8 from way before it had that name. It actually all started back in September of 2007, when the City Council of San Diego took a vote to sign on to a friend of the court brief to the state Supreme Court. In the year 2000, California had passed a statute defining marriage called Proposition 22. Then a few years later, it was around, I believe, 2006, the coalition that filed that, Protect Marriage, filed the same language as an amendment to the Constitution when they saw what was happening, but it never got enough support to qualify for the ballot. Well, after Mayor Gavin Newsom issued those same-sex marriage licenses in San Francisco, that gave the opportunity for some of those couples to challenge the law. It went through the system and was pending at the state Supreme Court, who was going to decide on its constitutionality. So a number of cities in California signed on to this front of the court brief to urge the court to overturn Proposition 22. And our city council, this came up all of a sudden. People didn't see this on the radar screen. At that time, the city council of San Diego had 8 members. Kind of a funny having an even number, but what happened was there was a tie vote. And one of the perhaps most liberal of the city council members actually voted no at that time, saying that they needed more time to discuss it. So it was on the agenda for the next council session 2 weeks later. That gave an opportunity for people to organize, and there was a group of Catholics that became very actively organized around this to go to the council meeting and speak their mind. They were looking to me for support. I wrote a letter to each of the city council members. I wrote a letter to the mayor, and I couldn't go to the meeting with them, but I celebrated a mass for them at a nearby parish before the council meeting, and they went over to the meeting. It was on the agenda for the afternoon, but there was a note in the agenda that they would move items up to the morning if they finished the morning agenda early, so our people had to be there from the beginning. And it wasn't addressed in the morning. They were there in the afternoon. The meeting was going on. A lot of the people had to leave because they had children in school and had to pick them up. Those who were there told me that about 15 minutes before it came up for discussion, around 20 people walked into the chambers, who obviously were people of influence and prominence, to argue the other side. And so they had the sense that this was all sort of a setup, and they realized what we were up against. One of the people there, one of the Catholic supporters, read my letter to the mayor because he wanted it entered into the record. And they told me afterwards that whenever these interventions were happening, the city council members were kind of fidgeting and distracted. But when he said he had a letter from a Catholic bishop, they all stopped and paid attention. And that gave them a sense that the church still had a voice of moral authority, and they were looking for support. It's not our role as ordained ministers to be involved in the political process, but we do have to support our people in carrying out their vocation as the lay faithful in changing society out in all the arenas of society. You know, I thought that before this happened, I was aware of what was going on around the country, but I thought this was something so obvious that it would just sort of correct itself, and I finally got the sense that it's not going to correct itself. Someone better do something. So this group began to organize, and we had a lot of discussions and strategizing. We knew about this marriage amendment that had been filed, and we thought maybe we should support this marriage amendment. But the time was already short. This is in October and November. We needed to file it by the third week of April. We didn't know if that was smart to do then or if we should wait until the experts told us who were with us on the issue, who knew California politics, that it was too much of a challenge. We had to raise a record amount, like $1.5 million, to pay professional signature gatherers and, in addition, get a record number of volunteer signatures. You can't do them all on volunteer signatures. And we had to file it by the third week of April, and they said that's just not possible. It's better to wait till June of 2010, so it would have been coming up in a couple of months, but because there would be more time to educate people on the issue, more time to raise money and so forth. But we knew the court decision was pending, and it wasn't a given which way the court was going to decide, but it seemed more likely than not that it would overturn Proposition 22. So with the people I was meeting with, really the shakers and movers of this group, well, we finally decided it was too much of a risk to take. We had to step forward in faith and place our trust in God. There was a lot of organizing and energy, but after a certain point, we were kind of spinning our wheels, and I realized we needed some real expertise. The leader of this group had invited Maggie Gallagher of the National Organization for Marriage to come in and speak to our group. And then here about in December, someone suggested to me, well, why don't you talk to Maggie? Maybe she'll help you out. Maggie and her organization have been working on the marriage issue for many years. They know all aspects of marriage. They know the politics of it, the law, the social benefits, the anthropology. They know what's going on around the country. They had real expertise. They had done studies, focus groups, and so forth. So I finally got the idea, you know what, they're the experts. We've done this initial organizing. We really should just hand it over to them. So I called Maggie in December and asked her if they would be willing to come into California to help manage this campaign for us. We had a mega conference call, with people in San Diego and people in Sacramento from the Protect Marriage Organization. It went on for about 2 hours, but I had asked Maggie to be available to come on the line if there was an openness to this. And she did, and we finally, everyone was convinced this was what we should do. This was December 23rd. So it was literally the morning of Christmas Eve day when Maggie in Princeton, New Jersey, met with her board and asked them if they would be willing to make this commitment to California, which obviously they did. And their executive director, in fact, who was living in Connecticut but visiting his family in California at the time, ended up not moving back, instead moving and staying in California to manage the campaign on the ground for us. So my role really was, in addition to the need to educate people on this and make them aware of what's at stake, was in connecting people who could make it happen. So I introduced Maggie to those who had the financial means to support the effort and those who had the political know-how to manage the campaign. It was also, though, we understood, primarily a spiritual effort. This is a spiritual battle that we were engaged in. And our people understood that and were committed to that. A very prominent pro-life activist in the San Diego area had been promoting a 54-day rosary novena for life. So we thought that that might be something we should do as we were trying to collect these 1.1 million signatures that we needed. I celebrated a mass to begin it, which happened to be the day before Ash Wednesday, and it would conclude on Divine Mercy Sunday. And I asked our people to offer up their Lenten fasting for the success of this effort. In the meantime, also in San Diego, a group of evangelical pastors were organizing around this issue. And some point along the line, I think it was about in February, they reached out to us, and they were having meetings among themselves, and they wanted to invite Catholic presence there. I wasn't able to go to the first meeting that they had. Some of our priests went. One of them was asked to offer a prayer, and then I, after that, became connected with them. One of the pastors was hosting these meetings at his church. He was hosting monthly meetings, and these ended up being teleconference meetings, linking up churches all across the state, and eventually even some in Arizona and Florida, which had their own marriage amendment initiatives. These were very well orchestrated. They were an hour and a half, the time down to the minute, different speakers from different aspects. Where is the campaign? How are we doing with gathering the signatures? What are the legal implications? And then the pastors who would give spiritual reflections and offer prayers. And I was always invited to take part in that. I still remember the first of these meetings I went to. This was early on before he had linked up all of these churches. And I was addressing this group of Protestant pastors. I said, you know, it might seem strange that here the Catholic bishop is addressing a group of evangelical Protestant pastors. And they said, no, they appreciated my presence there. I said, well, that comforts me, because actually, to tell you the truth, I long for the good old days when we had the luxury of being able to fight with each other over doctrinal issues. We don't have that luxury anymore. You know, when the ship is sinking, the crew can't be standing around debating what kind of navigational equipment they should install. The crew can only be doing one thing, saving the ship. And the ship that was sinking was not the church, an ancient image of the church, but our civilization. And they understood this as well. We both understood that this is an issue that defines civilization. We finally, by a miracle, qualified the proposition for the ballot, which became Proposition 8, but now we faced the daunting task of the advertising campaign to make people aware and of the issue. And that was going to take another huge effort. It was at this point that Catholic leadership in California spoke with the leadership of the LDS Church in Salt Lake City, very high-level leadership, and the Mormons made an exception to their policy of not getting involved in political campaigns and made a commitment to this effort, giving a contribution far, far beyond their proportion. And I can honestly say, if it were not for this commitment of the Mormons, we would have qualified it for the ballot, but it would have been dead in the water in terms of the financial and human support for this effort. The evangelicals also understood this as a spiritual battle, and something else we have in common with them is our understanding of spiritual warfare. And they had all kinds of what I thought were great ideas. 100 days of prayer leading up to the election, a family voter Sunday, Sunday in October, when the family would sit down at the kitchen table and go over the ballot and decide what the right way would be to vote. 40 days of fasting before the election, leading up to an event called The Call, led by a pastor by the name of Lou Engel, who has put on these. The Call is 12 hours of prayer and fasting, bringing together tens of thousands of people. And they invited him to come to San Diego to do it. He said it was the first time he had actually been invited. The other cities he'd done it in, he had asked to do it. And he really had this vision of spiritual renewal of California. And he shared his own story of going on a 40-day fast. And when they fast, it's literal fasting. It's not this sort of thing where you fast from being mean to your little sister. I mean, going without food for 40 days. He actually did that. He said he cheated twice, but serious fasting. And during this 40-day period leading up to this event called The Call, there's about 30-some young people from around the country, evangelical Christians, who came to San Diego to do nothing but fast and pray. They prayed all day and ate soup at night for 40 days to support our effort. The call took place on All Saints Day. It happened to be on a Saturday that day, and it was the Saturday before the election. And they wanted Catholic participation. I thought a lot of their ideas we can do in our Catholic way, so we had another 54-day Rosary Novena. This one began on the feast of the birth of Mary, September 8th, and concluded on the eve of the call, October 31st. I still remember the Mass concluding it was at the Italian church, actually the church my father grew up in. Right next door, maybe 10 feet away, is the hall. It happened to be the weekend they were having their major spaghetti fundraiser dinner, so the smell of the spaghetti sauce was wafting all through the church, and I had been fasting from not, I had a little bit to eat each day, but still, I was really hungry, and that God was tempting me. So, on this event called The Call, we had a Mass. The evangelical pastors were present for it. It was held in the stadium where the San Diego Chargers play, which happens to be about a mile, a little less, down the street from the Mission San Diego de Alcalá, where I was living at the time, the first church in California, which our evangelical brothers and sisters recognize as the first church in California, and recognize Father Serra as being the first one to bring Christianity to California. So we had the Mass for All Saints Day, and we processed to the stadium after the Mass to join the others who were already there chanting the Litany of Saints. So it was a great moment of unity in prayer around this this foundational issue. About 3 days before the election, the manager of the campaign sent an email out to everyone on his list saying that marriage was in cardiac arrest and we needed to raise $3 million in those 3 days before the election, and we needed $1 million in 24 hours. Because the other side had, in a period of 2 weeks, raised something like $7 to $8 million. Well, what were we going to do? I thought, well, someone will figure out something. The pastor I had been working closely with called me. A friend of his was a friend of a Catholic woman who had hosted a fundraiser at her home. I had only met her that time. He had met her through this other friend. And to make a long story short, we decided that I should contact this woman. And miraculously, I was available that night. I'm often not available in the evening. She was able to see me, and we were able to come up with the first $1 million and then the other $2 million within those 3 days. The point is that would not have been possible if we Catholics and evangelicals had not been working together and I had not formed that relationship with him. On election night, our group had reserved a suite at a hotel at Election Central, and it was about, no one wanted to go home until we knew the results of the election, and it was about 2 o'clock in the morning when the manager of the campaign called us from Sacramento, who from experience knew that we had won, and he called the election. And so we all just held our hands up in the air and broke out in prayer, and then at some point someone started singing the doxology to the tune of the old 100, the hymn that we all have in common. We knew that this victory meant that God was allowing us to continue the fight. It certainly wasn't over. But as I reflect back, why did we succeed? I think for these reasons. First, again, we understood it was a spiritual battle, and we engaged it at the level of prayer and fasting. Secondly, everyone working on this did it with self-disinterest. Nobody cared who got credit for what. We were doing it for the common good and for the glory of God. At events where I spoke with these pastors, often I'd be the one hailed more than they, and I thought, well, why are they hailing me? They're doing more than I am. Often those pastors got more interviews in the media and all that. I didn't care about that. It's because we all trusted each other and proved ourselves trustworthy. All these different elements, our Catholics, the evangelicals, the Mormons, the Protect Marriage people, they didn't know each other at first. But we chose to trust and prove ourselves trustworthy. And we stayed on message. The message is the good of marriage, that marriage is good for everyone. Marriage does not discriminate against anyone, that it had nothing to do with discrimination or taking away rights. But marriage benefits everyone. And I would always cite our catechism, cite other documents of the church about respecting human dignity of all people, people with same-sex attraction. We always emphasize the personhood, the human dignity of the human person. That is our where we focus on. We don't categorize people by some sort of a trait and dismiss them that way. But it's because marriage benefits everyone, and especially children. The UN Convention of Rights on the Child says that the best interests of the child, as the weaker, more vulnerable party, are to be the paramount consideration in every case. And also supporting marriage because of the consequences if we lose the definition of marriage in the law. We understand that these two ideas of marriage are incompatible. Only one can stand. We're right now locked in this battle of which one is going to stand. It's not live and let live. It's one idea that has to predominate, that marriage is the union of a man and a woman of lifelong fidelity, openness to the procreation and generation of children, or it's an arrangement between two adults given recognition in the law. Which is going to be best for our society, and what are the consequences for those who disagree for whichever one ends up winning out? But only one can be left standing. We also abided by having to do with staying on message by the direction of the campaign manager, who did the focus groups. He knew the messages that worked, and sometimes some of us had ideas of maybe doing things a little different in some cases, but we followed his lead because he knew best. So in other words, we worked together in solidarity. That's why I think we succeeded. Other lessons learned that can be helpful in going forward. First of all, this is a winnable battle. Despite the erosion of the marriage culture, people still recognize that there is something special and unique with the unions of husbands and wives. They might not be able to articulate it or define it, but they instinctively know that it's true. And this has been shown over and over again in very liberal states such as California, where it was overturned, and in Maine, where it was overturned, in New York and New Jersey, where it was blocked. When people instinctively understand this. Still, as Catholics, we have a catechetical crisis on our hand. 46% of self-identified Catholics voted against Proposition 8 in the election, and that number dropped after the campaign for it had started. That tells me, though, that if people are informed, then they will understand how important marriage is and how marriage benefits everyone, and it's not a matter of discrimination. So we need to have a major challenge educating our own people. People are concerned about the younger generation that have grown up with this mentality and are flooded with these ideas. But I think we also have an opportunity there. There were three messages that really resonated with Californians. One is that four judges overturned the vote of over 4 million people. Another was the consequences for religious liberties and what would be taught children in school. And the third was that children need a mother and a father. Big news. Newsflash. Children need a mother and a father. That was the one that resonated with the younger generation. They are the ones that are most victims of the demise of the marriage culture. So many of them having grown up without their mothers and fathers, with both parents, or if they were blessed enough to, their friends have. They're most affected by it. So if we can get them in touch with their own hurt, we have to be very sensitive. We can get them to realize how important marriage is, and maybe we have an opportunity to restore a marriage culture. Third lesson is that this is a new ecumenical moment. I spoke about the new sense of unity between Catholics and Evangelicals and Mormons as well. And your own Archbishop's talk at BYU is a very, I think, historically defining moment in that regard. Who would have thought even a few years ago a Catholic cardinal would have given an address at BYU, let alone an address like that, and be so warmly received? It's a moment for evangelization. Marriage is the key for evangelizing people because it's the key for understanding our relationship with God. The pastor that I was working closely with really came to have a very deep appreciation of this, understanding the mystical meaning of marriage, basically a sacramental understanding of marriage, even if not using that word, that what we call marriage is an image of the ultimate marriage of Christ and his church. So we all all three groups kind of envy each other for what we have. They envy us for the depth of our philosophical and theological reflection on this and understanding the mystical meaning of marriage. We envy them because they're so technically savvy and know how to organize and use modern means of communication. We all envy the Mormons because they're so much in solidarity and working together and united. We have a lot of great theory about solidarity, but they actually live it out, you know. Fourth lesson is that this is a time for the church to regain credibility. It's not a time to retreat. This happened in San Diego right after we went through the very humiliating bankruptcy process because of the sexual abuse lawsuits. A human reaction would have been, we need to retreat. This is not a time to be bold. But I counterintuitively thought it's precisely the time for the church to regain credibility. And in fact, a number of people told me after the election that they never felt so proud to be Catholic. And the fifth lesson, there will be a price to pay. People will be punished. During the campaign, 100,000 Yes on 8 signs were stolen or vandalized. People had their property vandalized. People were slandered in the press. People received avalanches of hate mail. Some even received death threats. Some people lost their jobs. Some were physically assaulted, one so severely that he had to be taken to the hospital and given stitches under his eye. They've had their businesses boycotted. And I never thought I would see such blatant religious bigotry as was perpetrated against the Mormons. We know anti-Catholicism is alive and well in this country, but usually it's masked in some way. But this was just blatant, explicit religious bigotry. What I would always tell people in concluding my comments during the campaign is that it may seem like we're up against cosmic forces against which we are powerless, and we can't see where it will lead. We didn't know what the outcome of the election would be. It wasn't a given either way. And we still don't know. We've gained a lot of momentum for the marriage movement, but we still don't know where this will end. But the question is not, will we succeed or not? The question is, how will history judge us 200, 300, 400 years from now when people look back at this moment of history, when the meaning of marriage was on the line? They'll ask, what did people of faith do during this historic moment? Did they get involved to protect and educate about this precious institution, or did they just retreat? The marriage, which is so central as well to the project of peace, if we understand the principle of human ecology. As the labor issue was the burning issue at the time of Pope Leo XIII, the burning issues of our time are marriage and the sanctity of human life, intimately connected issues. We can make the same mistake now of the false ideologies of the time of Pope Leo XIII and of the last century. The same mistake I see being made since the social upheavals of the 60s, which promised freedom, especially in the sexual realm, but has resulted in oppression. And we all know the oppressive results of this so-called sexual revolution, with soaring rates of out-of-wedlock births and prominence of abortion, increasing violence against women, especially domestic violence. The list goes on and on and on, the blight of inner city neighborhoods and so forth. All of this is because of the same mistake, a misunderstanding of the human person, which sees a human person only in the material sense, fails to recognize the spiritual and transcendent dimension of the human person, let alone its primacy. So I would ask you to, what do you do now? First and foremost, to engage on the spiritual level, to pray and to fast. I would ask you to, Friday is still a day of penance for us as Catholics. I don't know if very many people know that. We're encouraged to abstain from eating meat, but we can decide to impose another penance on ourselves instead. Practice fasting, at least on Fridays, and pray. At other times when the church was in a moment of crisis with threatening forces to undermine it, Catholics resorted to the rosary. If you're not already, most of you probably are, pray the rosary. Pray the rosary every day, and most especially spend time in Eucharistic adoration, the power of Christ's presence in the Blessed Sacrament, as we also heard in the video. Take time at least once a week, preferably every day, to pray before the Lord present in the Blessed Sacrament. This leads to what the ultimate question really is. The ultimate question is not, how will history judge us? The ultimate question is, how will God judge us? I believe that in every generation, God gives his people an opportunity to prove their faith and trust in him. Its own unique battle to fight. It's a challenge, but also an opportunity. It's a test of faith to stand up for what is right and true. This is the battle, challenge, and opportunity God has given us. As I said earlier, we Catholics, because of the insights of our Church's social and moral teaching, are uniquely poised to respond to this challenge and reverse our nation's slide toward self-destruction. This is a challenge and opportunity God gives to our generation. Let us seize this opportunity. And I would like to conclude, since we're reflecting on marriage and family, with the opening prayer for the Mass on the Feast of the Holy Family, and afterwards I will conclude with a blessing. So I'd invite you to please stand now. O God, you have given us the Holy Family of your Son as the perfect model for our families. Kindly grant that we may practice their virtues in family life and unite us by the bond of your love, that we may enjoy with them the eternal happiness of your home. We ask this through Christ our Lord.
Amen.
The Lord be with you. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord let his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. The Lord look upon you kindly and grant you his peace. The Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit.
Amen.
Thank you.
This talk was from the 3rd Annual Illinois Catholic Prayer Breakfast. For more information, go to www.illinoiscatholicprayerbreakfast.com. For more talks by excellent Catholic speakers, go to greatcatholichomilies.com.